what you think today will not necessarily be anything of tomorrow. It's like the law of impermanence, like the Buddhist law of impermanence, right? I think the abstract really reflects that, first of all, because every minute you stare at it, you see something new. And so it kind of engages your brain constantly, and you're constantly changing how you think about the images, and you just process it over time. So it's essentially, I'd say abstract is time-based media, which is even more interesting.
This is The Public. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you like what you hear, or if you don't, we're eager to hear from you. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. Today on The Public, we're talking about market research as an artistic process and about predictions of a dawning renaissance in the recorded music industry.
Today we're speaking with Jamie Sitar, who has had a long career in the Canadian music industry. Jamie, would you please tell us who you are and about some of that history in the Canadian music industry, why it is we should trust you?
Sure. My name is Jamie Sitar. I grew up in Winnipeg. I played in bar bands around here, moved myself out to Vancouver, got into the studio scene out there, ended up with a mastering studio, mastering a lot of records. Of note were things like the Swollen Members and hip-hop. Did a classified, two classified records. Worked for Randy Bachman, who's also living out there. Biff Naked. Chilliwack. All kinds of folk and roots music as well. So really kind of run the gamut. In a day, I might see, you know, everything from like lounge jazz to DOA, and that would be my day. Recently moved back to Manitoba, set my mastering studio up here, and I guess that's all there is. That's a decade and a half in a nutshell.
What does it mean to say that you master albums?
Well, when you're in the studio and the first thing you do is once you've written your songs and all that and you're happy with how things are playing out, you record them and you have everything separate, and then someone will mix them, so they'll combine those elements in such a way where everybody's happy with how it sounds. It sounds like a song in the studio, and you sign off out and you say, okay, that's the mix. I like how it sounds in the studio. It feels good. And then you have to make what feels good in the studio translate to, you know, people's stereos in the real world. And that's what mastering is. It's kind of like that last bridge.
So you're bridging the technologies, I suppose, the difference between the sound reproduction equipment that's in a studio and what you can expect people will have in their cars, in their homes, in their earphones?
Pretty much. I mean, you're basically the last... You know, the puck stops with you. You're the goalie. In the 60s, mastering was very much a mechanical thing. You're transferring it to vinyl, and you're dealing with those limitations of it. And you'd actually start, as an assistant, you would start by doing that, and then you would learn what a good mix was, and you would move into recording and mixing. When things got a little more complex with the release mediums and that kind of stuff, or when things moved into digital, let's just say, when things moved into digital and you can, there is no more mechanical restriction. You can put anything on a CD or a WAV file or an MP3 now. It becomes, you know, more of a creative process and less constrained by, you know, the mechanical playback, although you obviously want it to sound good. So this is just making sure that what sounds good in the studio is going to sound good out in the world there, whether it be, you know, an MP3 on an iPod with earbuds or coming out of a big club system.
So what do you think of these competing trends in the world today between the desire for convenience and a million MP3s in somebody's back pocket and the desire for truly audiophile quality music reproduction? It seems like both are really taking off.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, yeah, we have the capacity now for both, And if this is, we're looking at it in a democratic way, convenience is winning. Everybody wants to have a million songs in their back pocket that they can listen to anywhere. But, I mean, first of all, if you take a hearing test, the very first thing that they ask you is, do you listen to earbuds? Because they're bad for your, you know, your oral health. They'll make you deaf quicker than working in a loud environment. so it's not good for you. And to boot, having random access to everything ever done, that doesn't really help with your value of it. You know, if you had to jump through hoops or, you know, find some little record store somewhere on some little island to get a song you've been looking for, you've been on a quest for a decade or so, that meant something to you. So I think from an artistic, you know, for how you value art, you know, I'm on the audiophile side of the fence, if you can't tell.
I can, and I wonder, 99 cents for the MP3 isn't enough to you, it sounds like.
Well, I've never bought an MP3, and I've never stolen one either. I still listen to hard copy CD or SACD, which is a higher audiophile quality. I don't download files, even the higher resolution stuff, because I prefer to experience, I like to have a physical copy. I like the liner notes. and I like the, you know, the sense of holding it in my hand. And I like listening to an album at a time. I don't like shuffle. You know, I don't like the idea of shuffle.
Because you're more tapped into what it is the artist intended in terms of a series or a succession of music. And
well, I mean, that's being in my 30s, that's what I grew up with, is you had a concept and you made an album, and there were singles on that album, but really the album was a journey. With the new technology, I'm sure that, you know, people are now writing, you know, even an artist that would have written for an album will be writing more for a single, right? And it's more of a song-by-song approach. That's how it's always been on the, you know, the serious songwriters for money approach. But as far as an artist that was, you know, writing album-oriented rock, it was just a 70s term, you're now, you know, everybody's pretty much song-oriented. And if we look at our attention spans as a species from the 50s to now, you know, they went from, you know, over half an hour for the average college student to, I think, was it 3 minutes by the 60s to about 30 seconds now. So the length of a you know, a section of a symphonic piece to a pop song to a commercial, and I find that a bit of a disturbing trend. But I still like to, if I'm going to listen to music, I like to listen to a whole album.
So you spoke about people who are making music for money, investing more of themselves or different parts of themselves in it over the past 50 or 70 years. Recently, we had a guest on this show, Raymond Biesinger, speaking about trends in commercial art, and he's spoken about the future of the commercial arts, including recorded music, and he described that future as doom because of the rise of the hobbyist drowning out the professional artist, the professional musician. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it cuts both ways. There always has been, I mean, if you've heard something on the radio, somebody had to pour a substantial amount of money into it. And so there always has been a marriage of art and commerce. Now, depending on, you know, who's got the power in that relationship, and, you know, who's left with the power, like, you know, Jimi Hendrix wasn't, you know, he was on a pretty long leash. But say somebody like the Backstreet Boys may not have been, right? It's just a matter of, you know, the mail slot you want to deliver something through. I think if somebody really wants to get in professional, they're going to have to, you know, if somebody else is paying the bills, you're no longer calling the shots yourself. And it depends on how many shots you want to keep. And as much as the hobbyists are destroying, I guess, in a sense, the quality of what's coming out, or they have the potential to do that, it's also empowering a lot of artists who now no longer need to find that outside investment, who can make a smaller investment themselves and release stuff without having somebody else call the shots for them.
So it could lead to increased diversification in the music industry.
Absolutely. I help out a few artist friends of mine. Of note is a guy in Winnipeg named Scott Nolan, a very in-it roots artist. And he's got a full studio set up in his garage, which, you know, quite a few decades ago would have only been available to somebody like Paul McCartney or Pete Townsend. Now he's got a 64-track studio in his garage with a live room and some microphones, and he can cut something that is album quality in there, as long as, you know, there's somebody in there who knows the technical side of it. And he's picking that up, but he's bringing the art side of it too. I think there's a danger to wearing too many hats, because you're spreading yourself too thin. You got too many baskets and not enough eggs. But he's more than happy to bring in people who are good at what they do. And, I've helped him with a lot of engineering, and I think it's a fantastic thing because there's a lot of bills he doesn't have to pay. And as a professional artist, then that puts in a bottom line that, that he can deal with himself without having to have an outside record company. In Manitoba, at least, we have a very generous grant system for artists. And with the way things are now, I think we've got it to the point where... can you hold on for a second, Mike?
Sorry, no, I'm still here.
Okay, no, my daughter's just giving me a banana that she wants me to open.
Oh, I see.
And I'm going to have to put down the phone here.
Okay, sure.
You're welcome. Okay, I'm sorry about that.
Not at all.
I've actually got my studio set up in my home as kind of a cost-saving step. In the way things are right now, people are making less money for music, and so they want to spend less money on making music. So I myself have taken steps to kind of go for the bang for the buck approach. And I've got now a studio that I am at least as happy with in what was the living room of my house as what I had going on when I lived in Vancouver in commercial space.
And you attribute part of that, or the ability to do that, to the generous grant system in Manitoba. And certainly there's a fairly robust grant system for musicians in Canada as well. Could you speak about how that supports the Canadian music industry?
At this point, it's the life support system. There isn't a whole lot of label money like there have been. Things like artist development aren't really, that's almost unheard of now, whereas, you know, R&D was the lifeblood of any long-running company, and it's pretty much... The farm team now is you putting out your own records and then finally getting somebody's ear. Maybe the vehicle for that is publishing, getting your stuff in a TV show or a movie or a commercial, and then, you know, somebody going, well, where did I hear that song? And then kind of jumping into it. I know that I've gone out and bought records because I heard a song on a commercial or on a TV show and, you know, did a little research and found out who it was, and then, of course, bought the record so I could listen to the record. But I think the grant system now is basically enabling people to make records in a climate of there being not a lot of record company input, or financially anyways.
Some of the grants, I know there are a number of different grants that musicians can apply for, and some of them have been described as bets being placed on winners already. The systems are unwilling to invest in young and up-and-coming and unproven bands. The bands need to have an established track record before acquiring that investment.
Well, for example, I know you're about the same age as me, and you remember when Much Music used to play music videos.
That was a long time ago.
In the it was a while ago. But when you used to look at the bottom left-hand corner of the screen at the beginning and end of the video, they used to credit the song, the artist, and the label, and if there was any grant money. And, I mean, even what those grants were, even back in the 90s, was a way for Canadian artists with lower budgets to compete with American artists that had, you know, typically five times the budget. And so you'd have acts like the Tragically Hipped getting Video Fact money. You know, that's you just wonder about that, because if you think about it from the point of view of, well, this is supposed to be startup money so that an artist can kind of get out there and become self-sufficient, which was, I mean, that's the idea behind a lot of grants, is that, you know, eventually you do give back. It's an investment. You have pretty much the top of the Canadian game at that point receiving grant money. I mean, love them or hate them, that's just the way it went. at this point, I think they just want you to have a business plan in place. I'm not sure if they're betting on winners so much as they just want to see that you have, this goes back to eggs and baskets, but someone who's very much artistic may not have that much of a business sense, and depending on how they've got their egg distributed. And I think they just want to make sure that the funding agencies, that they're just not throwing money away. I don't think it's as bad as betting on winners, but there definitely is there's some business things that they like to see on grant proposals, just to know that they're dealing with someone who understands the game and what's going on and what's expected.
A couple of minutes ago, you said in the music industry, Jimi Hendrix was on a pretty long leash. The Backstreet Boys were on a short leash, but both of them were on leashes. And you were speaking about power in the music industry. Who has the power in the Canadian music industry right now?
That's a funny question. With any industry, particularly entertainment, you're looking at a lot of smoke and mirrors to make things appear larger than they are. You know, award shows are basically out there to bring attention to a scene. So, you know, the Grammys are meant to make the American music scene look bigger. The Junos are meant to make the Canadian music scene look bigger. You know, and all the movie and TV awards for those industries as well. Ultimately, the consumer has control. Anybody who's, money talks. And ultimately, the consumer is driving this. And if the consumers aren't willing to pay for quality, then you better bet that's the way things are going to go.
What about if the consumers aren't willing to pay at all? What do you think about the culture of free that we're experiencing right now?
It depends. You'll pay for something. And artists are realizing that. And the record companies are realizing that, too, with their 360 deals where they'll sign you, make a record for you, but then they own everything. Just like if people aren't willing to pay for the record, hopefully the record serves as an advertisement for your live show and you can make money off of touring. And, I mean, we even have a grant system in place to fund that. And your touring is funded by your merch. So hopefully somebody buys a T-shirt. Or if you really like a band, I'm not going to go to a bar and see a band and then, you know, maybe have a great time, maybe have a few drinks, go home and Google them and try to find a free download. Hopefully they've got CDs for sale. You know, even if I'm somebody who is listening to an MP3 player, and I don't even, you know, own CDs, or after I rip them into my computer, I throw them away. If you're really into a band, you want to take something home with you. And so I think the culture of free, it's interesting, and I think there's a lot of education that it's almost necessary. When I've had different union jobs as part of the education for the trade, you have to take basically a watered-down labor course where you learn the history of unions and the trade, the union movement and organized labor and all that. And it's really eye-opening, you know, for, how should I put this? You're probably going to want to cut this down. but it's really eye-opening as far as, you know, how it polarizes you, how you feel much stronger after you've learned where things have come from. And I think it's almost necessary in arts education now to have a bit of an intellectual property component to it, because if somebody doesn't want to pay for anything at all, eventually it's not going to be produced. You know, if I didn't want to pay for, you know, beef, you know, and that was a big thing, I don't think there'd be a lot of cattle farmers out there, you know, 5 years down the road. And I think it's going to be the same thing with music. I think we actually need to have some kind of an intellectual property education built into arts education, just so people will appreciate what's out there. Because there is a bit of a prevailing attitude that, you know, it's free. It doesn't belong to anybody.
That's the thing. There seems to be a real rift between the music, the product itself, and all of the labor invested by the individual who made it. Where do you think that comes from? Is it that rock stars aren't people anymore, and so people don't mind ripping them off, or is it that it...
I would say there's a bit of that, I think. People aren't idiots, and if they can see that, you know, things are a little more sugar-coated than they were, art's very safe, and you're meant to be spoon-fed this stuff, that they will be, you know, not to have anything against Nickelback, but I'm sure that there's a lot of people that, you know, would probably download one of their songs rather than buy it. You know, that, well, these guys are making enough money anyways. They're not going to miss a dollar. Versus, you know, your favorite indie band, you know, who's touring coast to coast and is depending on that free meal that they get before the show, you know, so they can buy gas to get to the next town. You know, it's economy of scale there. You know, in the 80s when things were along the lines that they are now, there's a lot more made to measure music out there that's, you know, trying to fit into the pocket of commercial. People were piping up about, you know, cassette dubbing back then, which, you know, looking back at it, wow, that wasn't even really a problem at all compared to what we got now. If I liked a band and I went to the library and I found their vinyl, then I could take it home and, you know, I still had to buy a cassette tape, which would send me back a couple bucks, and then I could dub it. But of course, I'd have to listen to the whole thing a couple times and take it in. And so it would still be more important to me than just pressing a button, you know, to get what I want. You know, you'd listen to it, you'd internalize it, you'd say, well, let's see, I could take one song off of here so it fits on one side on the cassette. Let's see, what do I like the best? And so there was still a conscious, you still became a fan and you still got sucked in. And, you know, maybe you'd still go out and buy a T-shirt or go to a concert or something because, you know, of that, it was still special to you even though you hadn't bought it. You know, there was investment on the consumer side.
Investment of effort.
Exactly. You know, you still had to at least listen to it. You know, if you got a cassette from the library, then you could do the high-speed dub thing. But you still had to hear it fast and, you know, in its entirety.
It's interesting the way this conversation is shaping up because there are two divergent tensions, as tensions tend to be, in opposite directions. One is speaking about the commercial necessity of the endeavor of making and selling music, and the other is about the investment of time, effort, emotion, that real connection to the piece of music. Music is the most readily accessible and widely consumed artistic endeavor in the Western culture. What do you think about that?
Is it?
It must be. I mean, how many teenagers do you know who buy paintings?
I guess that's true. I know a lot of teenagers who buy coffee.
There you go.
They might spend more on coffee than they do on music.
But as an artistic endeavor, as an expression of human creativity... I mean, they're getting pretty fancy with your cappuccino foam nowadays, but I don't know if I'd call coffee art.
True.
Whereas music is undeniably art, and it is the most, I would argue, widely distributed and democratically accessible art in Western culture. What do you think about that?
Absolutely true. I think the the new MP3 player technologies had a lot to do with that. I mean, even the the portable cassette player, the Walkman of the 80s, had pushed things forward a lot. Now you could go roller skating with your Walkman on, you know, where you couldn't do that with a record player before. You could play a tape in your car or an 8-track before that, although you didn't have any portable 8-track players. But now you can listen to things anywhere, and you can listen to it in a, I guess the package it's delivered in is small enough that even in our culture of ADD, we got shuffle mode. So you're only listening to an artist for 3 minutes, 3:30 in a single based consumptive environment, and it just fits. It fits with our consumer high turnover mentality.
And where do you think this is taking us then, as consumers of art, consumers of music, as economic or consuming citizens?
Well, I'm hoping that things go in cycles. And I'm hoping that this is kind of a down part of the cycle, like pop music kind of got to be in the 80s, before, you know, things like rock revitalized that by the end of the 80s, and then the whole grunge thing in the 90s. And even if you liked that or if you didn't, people were still suddenly spending more money on music again, and music became an important part of our culture, and not just necessarily something to be consumed. People cared about it. It wasn't just something that you went to a club to listen to loud, blast your head off while you're drinking. It was, it was considered art again. And I think it takes away from the art to be that accessible and to be that, just to have anything in the history of music at your fingertips makes it less special. I think people are going to come around. People will always love music. There will always be people out there who love music, and it will always be special to some people. And I think we're going to see that wave come back again, and we're going to see things be special to people. I mean, we're seeing a bit of a resurgence in vinyl right now. I know a guy who runs a flea market here in Winnipeg. His name's John McGowan. He's been in the music scene for a long time. And he runs a flea market or a booth at a flea market here on Sundays selling used music. And he sells CDs and records. And he told me that he sells about 25 or 26 pieces of vinyl to one CD. And you're pretty much sitting down. You're not just listening to singles if you're listening to vinyl. You're listening to at least a side. So that tells me that those people are still out there.
Yeah, it's a commitment to listen to a record.
Absolutely. And there's still people out there who are making that commitment.
So after a decade or more, maybe a couple of decades in the music industry, you've certainly gained some interesting perspectives, so thank you very much. But you must have also gained some interesting experience. Do you have any rock and roll lifestyle stories you care to share about, dumping over tubs of beans in hotel rooms a la Led Zeppelin or...
Let's see.
Sounds like you've never dumped over a tub of beans in a hotel.
No, I've never thrown a TV out a window myself.
No?
But I'm just seeing here what we can get away with without being censored.
Oh, you can get away with anything. This is university radio.
Oh, it's a university station. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I do remember, and this isn't a particularly wild story, but something that sticks in my mind. In junior high school, I was really into a heavy metal band called Anthrax. They were, they were what was important to me. And yeah, I dubbed some of their tapes, but I bought them when I could and bought T-shirts, would have gone to shows if I could have afforded it. And so fast forward, and I'm in probably my late 20s, and I'm sitting in Biff Naked's condo in Vancouver, and her American management team is in town, and it happens to be the people who managed Anthrax in their heyday. and we're all sitting around drinking moonshine and having a gay old time. And it just hit me. I realized that, hey, that's them. That's John and Marsha Zazula of Crazed Management. Holy cow. You know, they owned my soul when I was 14 years old. Or they were in control, as we get back to that whole leash thing. They controlled the entity that you know, I cared about the most when I was in my teens. And it was just, it was kind of mind-blowing. That's not really a rock and roll lifestyle story, but that was a mind-blowing moment for me.
It's interesting that your brush with stardom wasn't your brush with Michael Jackson or, I don't know, the star himself, but with a producer and a management team behind the band.
Yeah, it's the almost the cycle of life, right? I mean, that band went on to work with other people and everything, but when you're behind the scenes and you see how things work, it's like the analogy of the cave in Plato's Republic, you know, where the average person only sees the shadows of what's actually happening. And if you've seen the inner workings of how things actually work, that's what impresses you more.
So tell us about those inner workings, Mr. Plato quoting rock and roll guy. Well, who's pulling the strings then? Or what are the inner mechanics that would astound people? I mean, driving a soundboard is interesting, as the producer Quinn can tell us all, I'm sure. But it's not the same as strumming the strings on a guitar. And yet, both people are so important to it. How would you describe the relationship between masterers, producers, recorders, studio techs, etc., and the artists themselves?
I think they're complementary skill sets. And, how can I put this? Can you hold on for a second, Mike?
Of course.
Okay. Casey Lou, Dad's on the phone, okay? Can you ask Mom to do this next time? I'll get you a piece of paper. Here you go. Yeah, my studio is just off of my kitchen.
Excellent.
And, anyways, we're just wrapping up after dinner here. I'm actually talking to you from the studio. The musicians and producers and engineers and marketing and business people, we're all working towards the common goal, really, which is taking a great product, you know, and that's either a song, an album, an artist or whatever, and getting it to the masses. And so, say someone like, here's another out there reference, you know, the Leo Mull Sculpture Garden in Winnipeg, bronze statues, just outside the zoo. You actually, as a sculptor, he didn't just carve big chunks of bronze. There's a whole, positive-negative thing that goes on. So you have to carve you make your initial carving, and then you make a mold, and then you pour it. And apparently, he wasn't much of into casting, which is the most important part, because that's what makes the finished thing that everybody sees. But it is a multi-stage process, and you know, our friend Sasha that we went to high school with actually showed me. You could tell it's fine detail to the untrained eye, but you could see the ones that he had cast himself and the ones that they had brought someone who specialized in casting in to do. The ones that someone who specialized in were done better, and there were flaws in the ones that the actual sculptor himself had done. And that goes back to the eggs and baskets thing. It's one person's job to actually come up with the art, you know, and have something in their head. It's somebody else's job to then make that translate into basically from a business sense into a product. And then it's somebody else to actually have the business acumen to get that product into people's hands and then to get people paid so that, you know, they can continue to do that job full time. And if you're doing something full-time, you're going to be better at it than somebody who's doing it part-time. So, you know, money really does grease the gears.
You're destroying my basement bedroom rock and roll dreams of my teenage years.
That you can't do it all yourself?
Well, that it's Well, that's part of it, and that there's money involved and specialization, and yeah, that you can't do it all yourself, that you can't be a rock star all by your lonesome.
I mean, it's a team effort. Everything's a team effort, and I mean, some people seem like they're more important than others because, you know, money's changing hands, and some people are closer to the money than others, but there would be no money if there was no, you know, spark, if there was no creativity. So it is more of a team. And
So, Jamie Sitar, I have a question for you about living your rock and roll lifestyle with a studio in your home while your daughter comes and asks you to open her banana. How does it feel being an adult in the rock and roll business?
I mean, it feels different than it did being a teenager in the rock and roll business. I mean, you learn a couple things. You actually, going back to the Plato reference, you see what's actually making the shadows. It was, for me, this was a starting over. I, at one point, saw Armageddon. I thought the music industry was done. And in my very early 30s, I got out of it. I started fixing elevators because I thought, there's no way this can keep up. You know, in the middle part of last decade, record companies were actually, they figured they could spend their way out of the problem. And so I actually got busier, you know, as the whole industry was going downhill. I got to the point where I had to hire an assistant for my assistant. Things got crazy busy. And then by about 2007, you really started to see the writing on the wall. You know, like I hadn't even left the studio in months. I went to downtown Vancouver, and suddenly the stores that sold CDs, you know, the selection was nothing. And places were closing left and right. And it was a different place than the last time I had, you know, gone outside. And so I got out of it wholesale. And I sold my studio off. I sold the business. And I walked into another trade. I figured I was young enough to do that. I was starting to be a grown up. I had a family and all that. And now I'm actually getting back into it and being a grown up and learning a thing or two and actually taking a moment or a few years to kind of look at it from the outside. It was easier to set up again. You know, just with the perspective. Perspective is key.
Do you have any thoughts on why it is that Winnipeg has just such a powerful creative community and an amazing history of producing really amazing musical acts?
It's the winter. You know, you're woodshedding for half the year, and you got to do something. And if you are, you know, eventually you get bored and you have to go out to the bar. And it's some people's job to entertain, and it's other people's job to drink and pay for the entertainment. And so people tend to spend some time and get good at things here. I think that's really all there is to it. Yeah, the studio is in my house, and I think that's really the new world order. As far as you know, economies of scale and keeping costs where they make sense, and that's part of it. I'm Mr. Mom now, and you know, and there's this room that has giant speakers and a whole bunch of vacuum tube gear in it. And then there's, you know, my kitchen here in the other room, and that's life.
And the children have learned not to touch the glowing tubes, have they?
Yeah, you know, you get burned once and that's that.
Yeah.
The cats, however, curiosity still, well, it hasn't killed them yet, but I do have to actually check to make sure that buttons aren't pressed and knobs aren't changed positions from yesterday if I'm working on something over a couple of days. Because with all the lights and everything, it is fun for them.
Oh, I'll bet.
But it makes life a lot more interesting. I don't know. It's been a real... it feels more human, you know, from having commercial space in Vancouver to having, you know, something that on quality is, you know, in quality wise is on par, but just off of the kitchen, so that, you know, my pets are here, my family's here, you know, my, everything's here, you know, it's all in one place, and it's, you feel more like a human being. You know, there's a lot of things people would ask me to do. If somebody wanted a last-minute change on something, I would have to back out of family activities. You know, that was in the olden days of having a commercial facility. And I'd have to go to the studio, and you'd have to either download something or boot something back up, and you'd be there for a few hours. And now, you know, I can press a couple buttons depending on what we need. Well, things are getting started here. I can go back into the kitchen, do some dishes, read the kids a bedtime story, and then get back to it. So I think it allows everybody to be more of a human being than it was previously.
We should all be so lucky.
I'm a fan, anyways. I think, like I say, I think we're on the verge of a renaissance. A lot of big people are setting up in their homes, and I think it's a good thing. I think ultimately it will lead to taking back the art. I think for as much doom and gloom as people talk about, I think there is a silver lining in the clouds here. And having seen what I've seen, and having seen the empowerment that technology has actually given to serious artists, I think that we're actually we're just outside of a renaissance. I think we're about to see a big resurgence in people making their own records, but actually making quality records. And you know, it's going to basically weed out. If people are only in it for money in a dying industry, they won't be in it for long. And as much as studio recording, I mean, there is a high end of it, but it's almost a thing where it's like the trophy wife for the guy with money. I know somebody who just moved back here from L.A. who said he couldn't compete, you know, in the music industry there, because everybody working down there was, you know, like a kid with a, what do you call that? I mean, you get your parents put away money for you.
Oh, trust fund.
That's right. It's a bunch of trust fund kids running around down there. And you can't compete for work with people who don't need to work. So he, you know, came back here, and that's the high end of the industry. So I think once you've weeded all that out, and then that part of the cycle is done, I think you're going to be left with a very, very solid artistic core, and I think we're actually going to see some good times and some good art.
That was Plato referencing Juno Award-winning recording engineer Jamie Sitar. Saren Galway is a Toronto-based visual artist, illustrator, and connector of up-and-coming artists. He describes his style as Pomo Street Abex, or postmodern street abstract expressionism, and he's given a lot of thought to the entrepreneurial aspects of the art industry.
On the Social Art Movement blog, in an article titled Paint for Yourself or Paint for the People, A Tale of Two Business Models, Justin Christopher Day examined the business models and philosophies of two artists, yourself and Carolyn King. And in describing you, Day wrote, Saren is a self-styled capitalist who believes strongly in the free market's potential for shaping his art business. What does this mean?
It means that later in the article, it actually states this a little bit cleaner, that it's essentially you produce such a large body of work, and this is where I was from on the street, where I'd produce 25 of those paintings off of a larger sheet. I'd trim it down, and then I would try and see what imagery people like. And then you can kind of market yourself into a particular manner where you can find, like, it's like surveys. It's like taking economic surveys of finding what people will spend money on, right? So if I develop certain things, and I kind of came to the conclusion that if you slap a pair of tits on something, it sells. That's kind of how it works. And that was the only thing I came out of after living 3 months on the street, that if I put boobs on something, that was it. And it allows you to see what your, like, what your target market is and what the age is. Like, it's a total, you can kind of shape an entire business plan about what your product is. So it's, once again, shaping a product rather than a $1,500 masterpiece, right? So it's like, it allows me to make more money, which allows me to survive and make sustainability. And it's really happy when you sell something like that. So,
what does it say about authenticity then if an artist is molding him or herself to the market as opposed to molding the market to his expressions of truth?
I'd say I do both, actually, which is I say that I'm still stylized. I still like producing what I like and things like that. Like, I spend a decent amount of time. All my work is authentic. They're original pieces, but they're at such a reduced price that I can make smaller pieces and sell them for a lower profit and make more money that way. So it's better rather than, I wouldn't say, it's once again, it's still quality but quantity at the same time. It's mass production, or at least that's what I think it is. I wouldn't say that I'm totally tailoring myself. I'm just using subject matter that I and both other people can relate to. So I'm not necessarily like bowing down and taking it up the bum for the man or anything like that. I'm still producing work and things like that I greatly enjoy. So, and you meet a lot more people when you do that way. So there's a lot more different topic matter. A lot of people get more engaged. If you have different separate topics, you can be like, oh, I think of this when I see that. And oh, I like that one. I like that one. Like I can sit down on the street of Spadina and Queen, and I can sell and make probably about $120 a day, which is the same as a full-time job making minimum wage for working 6 hours. It's pretty decent, actually. So
there you go.
Yeah.
It's a very commercial perspective on the creative arts as opposed to the lofty ideal a lot of people have in their minds when they think of the arts. They think of ivory towers and they think of studios and the philosophical pursuit of perfection, I suppose. What do you think your perspective on the creative process says about the way the culture produces and consumes the fruits of our labors?
I'm actually getting a tattoo about this question, which is even better. It's kind of like a circle, and it's you know the recycling sign.
Mm-hmm.
It's instead of it having three points, it's just two, and it says art and culture. And so art produces culture, and culture produces art, because we're constantly influenced by different elements, and they just feed off of each other eternally. And it's I think not everybody that I've come in contact to that aren't artists have this kind of, you're absolutely right, this idealistic lofty concept of the 1980s where everybody's conceptual and we're working on it, and that's not absolutely true. There's totally two different ways and two separate kinds of artists out there nowadays, which is a conceptual artist, which produces the work, which I find is more into making those masterpieces, those long things. It's more, it does engage the audience per se, but also, and then there's like the artist who paints for the sake of painting. And I found like, I don't know, like I lost my train of thought.
Well, getting back to this idea, you've created a dichotomy between art creating culture, culture creating art, the two feeding off of each other, but all of this is situated within an economic situation.
Yes.
So where would you position the dollar bill in this?
The dollar bill would definitely be...
over top, underneath?
I think they're attached to both, to be honest with you. Because art makes money, and what sells in art, or what's going on in art, affects culture, because a lot of people like what they see in art, right? So they're like, oh man, like... I like that polka dot shirt. Polka dot shirt becomes the next like fabric for a t-shirt. T-shirt goes there, and then it just blows up even more so, right? So they just kind of like, it just keeps feeding and feeding and feeding, and like it's just, it will never end. And so the dollar bill is in both sides. It's just, it's where PR is located. It's where you get your product or your thing out the fastest to the most amount of people, and that's how you influence art and culture at the same time. So the artist is pretty much smack dab in the middle, connected to both. So, along with the dollar bill, I guess, which is just lay it over top, crush both of them, to be honest with you.
This is a particularly modern, or I'll call it contemporary, but it's a very now interpretation of art by situating it within such a commercial and an economic model or understanding, whereas in most previous centuries, art would have been enabled by money, but ultimately freed by it. An artist would have had a patron who might have decided on their direction, but also would have enabled that artist to pursue his or her own interests and the expression thereof. Do you see this as a distinction or a deviation from that historical trend, or an extension thereof?
I think it's exactly the same, to be honest with you. Because imagine, with these patrons, they want to see a particular object. or they want to see a particular product once again, right? The people or the people paying for your work want to see something they like. And if they like your style, you find one person that does that. And hopefully someone will find you in your, in the 1980s, they'd find you in your studio and you'd be working. And this is based off like a Basquiat kind of thing, but, and like Andy Warhol and all this stuff. So the big, the huge names of the 1980s, like contemporary art scene. But like, it's not, it's, yeah, it hasn't changed much, to be honest with you. It's still who's throwing down the cash that controls how it's working. But we, I think artists have this kind of weird, strange kind of think that they, that, that they can just produce whatever they want and they'll get the respect that they need. And that's not absolutely true at all.
So if the cash is steering the creation, then do you think if in previous eras there was a, it was a single patron who was steering by making those decisions, saying I want a painting of this or I want a sculpture of Hercules or whatever, and deciding what the artist's subject was, and now in this model it's much more democratized, I'll call it, by being product of market research, as you described it, or by tapping into the interests of a group as opposed to an individual? Do you think that fragments or liberates the artist in their creative process?
It depends on the artist, actually. So it's, if you work better under maybe multiple separate ideas, or people coming up with ideas and saying, hey, you should paint this, you should paint this, you should paint this, you should paint this, or I want to see this, I want to see this, right? Even that fine-tunes an artist's style per se, but if they can operate within that, you have to be able to be comfortable to versatility. You have to be a versatile artist. The more diverse you are, the more inputs you can have, the more money you make. So it's the jack of all trades, and I'm not going to say master of none, but maybe, I don't know.
You've written that you enjoy building bridges between traditional art styles or techniques on the one hand with either playful subject matter or street art brashness, which is evident in this Enzo table, but also in the rest of your work as well. I'm wondering about what motivates this. Why build bridges?
It's more about kind of linking. I find that the art world nowadays has become way too sophisticated. I believe that it's like, it's all about conceptual work. It's too hoity-toity for my taste, right? I'm not a hoity-toity guy. I remember being a redneck in Reno, Nevada, and then coming here and being like, have to adapt, right? And so I go to like all these art things, and what makes money is like these totally sophisticated art parties and drinking wine and like stuff like that. And I was like, you know what? Everybody else in the world seems to either think that you need to take it down a notch or flip it upside down. And that's pretty much my goal, is just to turn everything upside down. Like, I really great, like the most contemporary successful artists are either urban-based, street-based artists, or that are at least making a decent amount of dough nowadays, and like have a different perspective that they're adding to it. That's not normally traditional, that has been within the last 50 years. So,
you've written that you always include pink in your work because the color is a gender barrier, which you can use to engage your audience. What do you mean by that?
Traditionally, it's so known as a female color now, but back in the day, pink used to be blue and blue used to be pink in the way of gender kind of specifications. And so I really like touching it because it's, A, it pops off the page and punches you in the face, and two, it just like really solidly, like it creates a lot of tension and a lot of things. Like it makes you think about the color pink, which is really cool.
And you tend in your art to create dense and rich backgrounds or surfaces into which lines and shapes of your foreground objects are carved. Would you tell us about that style and its intent?
It would be, once again, it's from this like abstraction and bringing something out of abstraction. So it's a huge strain on my kind of like imagination of like, if you work on something like, I'm working on these four pieces right now that are so abstract to the point where my brain can't even make images out of them, where it's like, and for me that's kind of like this it's kind of like forcing yourself to think and making like, trying to like, how, what can I can imagine, what are those angles doing, which direction is that, and then it allows you to kind of compositionally look at things, and you can deal in whole new levels. It's like if you drew something out of white noise, which is I think really kind of cool.
Do you think this is a reflection of something broader in terms of your experience, your perspective on the commercial or the artistic community?
The original idea was the entire series that has about maybe 200 and change pieces that I've worked on. the last 2 years. They were called distressed identities, where it was people that I would see, like, how the morphing of personalities change in different situations. Like, what you think today will not necessarily be anything of tomorrow. It's like the law of impermanence, like the Buddhist law of impermanence, right? I think the abstract really reflects that, first of all, because every minute you stare at it, you see something new. And so it kind of engages your brain constantly, and you're constantly changing how you think about the images, and you just process it over time. So it's essentially, I'd say abstract is time-based media, which is even more interesting. So from there you can just kind of like work on different identities, and I really like dealing with people. I'm a people person. I love just having people around constantly, and like for me that's just kind of a part of who I've always been. And so from there it just kind of, I don't know, it's worked for me for a long time, just because the figure or the face is such a focal point that I'm going to say this actually, it's a total cop-out, because you can immediately create a focal point within a piece, but where you place that compositionally is kind of difficult. So if you can put in a face or a body part that people immediately connect to, because you always will, psychologically we are bound to stare at a face. We'll find faces in everything. And I like that kind of concept, because we'll try and relate to everything. So people immediately, when they look at my paintings, are forced to relate. They'll be like, oh man, that's a person, I'm a person. Let's be people together, kind of thing. And so I'd hope it engages the audience to make them think about themselves, perhaps. And I've kind of made this my ethos for a really long time, that it's not really about me, it's about the audience per se. And all my work has always been about the audience. It's just me portraying a person that looks at the canvas in a different light than they usually would kind of expect themselves to look.
And you mentioned you have a show coming up on March 17th at Video Fag with Sybil Lamb. Would you tell us about that show?
God Miss America is a show that based on the perspective of two Canadians that used to be Americans. The subject matter for the show itself is to try and be as low and brash, because both me and Sybil Lamb are very, very brash people. Very brash. So I've had a few life drawings sessions at my house where I've just asked my friends to like strip down naked and just draw penises for like 6 hours. It's just like fantastic. I've been trying to think of just different imagery that doesn't relate to the sophisticated art world in any sense. And we're marketing the entire thing from 99 cents up. So it's like you can either go in there, you can spend like a loony and a toonie, and you can actually get some decent work, which is great. And we'll have some big pieces there for all the sophisticated art people that really want to throw down $500 on a painting.
That was artist Saren Galloway, who has a show at Art Fag in Kensington Market on March 17th. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you have something you'd like to add, please be in touch. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or through ciut.fm. You can also email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. That's our show this week. We hope you'll tune in again. Because our first guest, Jamie Sitar, quoted Plato's Story of the Cave, we'll close today's show with Canadian garage band Platon et les Caves and their song Vivre avec toi. Alors que je te revois dans mes rêves et que je songe à tous ces souvenirs, la vie est si belle quand on s'aimait tous deux. Voilà, maintenant je me retrouve seul, car toi et moi, maintenant c'est bien fini. Moi, tu sais, je ne sens plus à toi. Je pourrais pas vivre avec toi.